Welcome to Conversations Live. For more than a decade, we've brought you the best in books, entertainment, celebrity interviews, and current events. When the movers and shakers of the world have something to say to you, they say it to us first. Here's your host, Cyrus Webb.
Welcome back, everyone. The Conversation's Live. I'm your host, Cyrus Webb. Glad you all could join us once again. For our radio audience tuning in at WYAD 94.1 FM and WYADonline.com, we're glad that you all can be with us. Also, tuning in to our online affiliates around the world via our podcast, we're glad you all could be with us as well. We're excited to welcome Ken Grossinger to our broadcast today. He's the author of a book I think you guys are going to really appreciate. For those of you who have been able to have your creative voices being used to be a part of great projects and to be able to make change, you'll really appreciate the book. It's called Artworks, How Organizers and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. We're going to talk to Ken not only about what it's like for him to write and research this book, but also to see the impact that the arts have been able to make, how they can be a force for change, but also the part that all of us can have in supporting it and also, of course, spreading the word. If you guys are just not hearing about Artworks, we'll let you know how to get your own copy of the book. Ken, thank you again for spending some time with us. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much, Cyrus. I appreciate the opportunity not only to talk with you, but to talk with your listeners.
Well, I appreciate that. And it's such a timely topic. You know, I have, in my life, even though I was the only person in my immediate family, Ken, who was involved in the arts. You know, my family has always appreciated the arts and supported it in their own way, but I think your book really does show how it's not just something for us to be able to listen to and look at, but really for us something to be able to feel and to spur some people to action. What has that been like for you to kind of look at the role of the arts when it comes to change and being able to chronicle that in the book?
So the book was 3 years in the making, 184 interviews, and I come to the book from outside of the art world. I spent most of my career as an activist in community organizations and in labor organizations. And during 30-plus years of doing that work, art and culture were never really part of what I did when I was taught how to think strategically about organizing. I wasn't taught it. When I practiced it, I didn't practice it. And when I started teaching younger activists how to think about it, it wasn't a part of what I did. And then I married an artist. And I realized how big a boat I missed, and that it wasn't just organizers that didn't think strategically about art and culture, but it was artists themselves that often didn't think about their work in the service of social movements. So I wanted to write a book that made the case that art was not just a reflection of or a reaction to social conditions, but a contributor to social change. And so I do that through the lens of the Civil Rights and Black Lives Matter movement, through environmental and immigrant justice, and looking at two different institutions, philanthropy and museums, and exploring the extent to which they support or disrupt social change strategies.
Yeah, and I think sometimes even giving a voice to those who feel like they don't have a voice, Ken, you talk about in the chapter No Paper, No Fear, about the role of organizations like Define American, which is something I'd never had heard of before reading this book, and how it was able to help individuals get a voice, those who may have been undocumented, but those who also had something to say. What was that like for you to see, how that through organizations and projects like that, that people who may have felt invisible were able to be seen and heard?
Yeah, it feels very powerful. You know, if I could, Cyrus, I'd love to read a couple of paragraphs from the book.
Oh, sure.
That talks to this very question.
Okay.
It's from an interview I did with Pablo Alvarado, who started an organization called the National Day Laborers Organizing Network. And he is one of the few activist organizations and unions that use very intentionally art and culture in their practice. And I wanted to know why. And here's what he said. What happens is when you're a worker and your wages are stolen, you're mistreated. When you're an immigrant and you don't have papers, just the fact of not having documents puts you in a vulnerable position, not just in front of society, but within yourself. You don't feel that you fit. You feel that you are a burden. You feel that you are an outsider all the time. So in order to organize and to make sure that people defend themselves when they are subjected to oppression, to difficult situations, you have to elevate the self-esteem. You have to build a cultural identity that people feel that they belong to. Because when you have that, when you have a strong cultural root, cultural background and identity, it's very difficult for an employer to come and rob you of your wages. To us, using arts and culture is a matter of building that kind of power. You cannot build real power unless people have an incredible sense of self-regard, self-love. This is why we incorporate art.
Wow. And it goes to, I think, for people like yourself, Ken, and as you mentioned, I'm so glad that you mentioned to our audience coming outside of the art world and having that appreciation. I think, you know, for so many people, a lot of times, and I think we're seeing this more and more, Ken, I'm curious to see your thoughts about this, that people are realizing that it's more than just, as I said in my intro, about words that sound nice and something that looks nice. It really is telling a story of those who otherwise have no other means to let their stories be known. Is that kind of what you were able to see as well?
Yeah. I mean, we know that through organizing and advocacy and lobbying, we can sometimes win legislative and policy victories. But what happens is when power changes hands, those victories often get rolled back. And I think it's because the narratives underlying those fights never get addressed. So we see the pendulum swing from the left to the right. And art has the capacity, in a way that organizers don't, to penetrate popular culture because it touches the heart. And so if we want lasting social change, it's really important to integrate that narrative work, that art and cultural work, with the activism that we're so used to.
And I also love, as you were able to share with the interviews and the stories, also we're able to see these captivating photos. Many of them, of course, will bring up incidents that we have seen definitely lately. Of course, George Floyd was featured in one. And also, of course, there is this this photo that is pictured with this woman standing in front of a line of police with their batons. Talk to us about the art and the contribution to that, to what you're able to share here.
So there has been this arc between the civil rights movement and the Black Lives Matter movement, and the images that you're drawing from, of course, are from the Black Lives Matter movement. And I wanted to make the point that the art of the Black Lives Matter movement really built upon the art of the civil rights movement. The George Floyd murals, thousands of them were created, and not just in the U.S., in Europe, in Australia, in Syria, in Palestine. And in the U.S., they became centers for grieving. They became centers for mutual support, and they became centers for calls to action to hold the police accountable. And it wasn't just their physical presence, but what we didn't have in the civil rights movement that we had in the Black Lives Matter movement is we had social media. And social media amplified images like that throughout the world, just as they did with music. If you go to the YouTube websites and look at some of the musicians that were very active in the Black Lives Matter movement, you'll see tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of people have heard those songs. So there's been an exponential increase through social media of our outreach.
Love that. And I think, too, that is why this book is so important. Ken, I was curious about something as I was reading it and reflecting on what you were able to share when you talk about collaboration. And we're talking about everything. I want our audience to know we're not just talking about social justice. We're talking about things dealing with the environment, you know, and just change in general. Did the book evolve in the direction that you expected, or were there twists and turns that you were not expecting when you first started writing the book?
It's a really good question. There were definitely twists and turns throughout the development of the book, and I became much more grounded in the role of not just the art, the power of the art, and the influences of organizers, but the artists themselves and their relationship to organizing. So I tell a story in the second chapter of the book about environmental justice. and it takes place in Bristol Bay, Alaska. And Bristol Bay is a 65% indigenous community, and there are two major industries in Alaska, the fishing industry and the extractive mining industries. And up in Bristol Bay, the extractive mining industries wanted to build an open pit mine, the largest open pit copper and gold mine that would be in the world. And in order to build that kind of mine, you have to have a place that holds the toxic waste. And so they would have had to have built a 70-foot earthen dam to hold it, something like 10 billion square meters of toxic waste. And they wanted to build that 150 miles away from an earthquake fault. In the turn of the century, it was the second largest earthquake ever recorded. And so if there were to be another earthquake, that community would have been wiped away. And the fishing industry, and both commercial for sport and for sustenance, began a fight with the extractive mining industries to stop the mine. And about 10 years into the fight, they realized one of the things that they were missing was an anthem, a campaign theme song. And so they called up a musician named Cy Khan, who they persuaded to come to Alaska from Asheville, North Carolina. And Cy goes up there, and they kind of schedule a tour for him. And one of the first places they bring him is into a third grade class, known as the Rebels to the Pebble. And Cy said, in whatever way you say to third graders, I'll be your musical messenger if you can give me the message. And then what Cy did was create a number of songs and brought them into people's homes, house meetings, 15, 20, 25 people, several of them. And he would say to people in those homes, does this song reflect what it is you feel? Does this line get the right message out? Do you like this song? Do you want me to jettison the song? And through doing that, he developed trust with the community. And so what they said to Cy eventually is that we've got Alaska covered. We need you to go down to the lower 48 and organize other musicians, help us raise money for this fight. And the point of that whole story is that it wasn't just the art. It wasn't just the song, the power of the song. It was the role that the artist played in conjunction with the organizing that was going on. And that is one of the things that I learned about over and over and over in these interviews, that it wasn't just about one or the other, but about the collaboration, the impact of collaboration.
And Ken, I have to say, the book is inspiring. Now, some of the issues and circumstances, of course, are not things that are pleasant, but the book is inspiring because it shows that even though people have had to look through different situations, community leaders having to deal with things like, as you mentioned, with Breonna Taylor, what happened in 2020, and others, that people are not giving up, and people are using whatever means at their disposal to be able to make sure that these individuals are not forgotten, but also, you know, also using those gifts as a way of pushing for the change that they want. Talk to us about that. What was that like for you to see the optimism they had, and how did that help you in your own optimism?
It really, you know, the Breonna Taylor story is really important because it really frames museums and institutions that most Americans trust. Now, trust these days is not a particularly high bar given what's going on in Congress and the Supreme Court and so forth. But nevertheless, when people walk into a museum, they trust what it is that they get. And when Breonna Taylor was killed, the Speed Museum in Louisville, Kentucky, asked itself what it means to be a museum in the time of Black Lives Matter. And during that same period, Ta-Nehisi Coates asked Amy Sherrill, the woman who did the portrait of Michelle Obama that's in the National Portrait Gallery, if she would do a portrait of Breonna Taylor. And Amy said, yes, but I want it shown in Louisville. And so the director of the Louisville Museum, the Speed Museum, emptied out three or four galleries and created two advisory boards. One was an advisory board made up of artists who had family members killed or maimed by the police. And the other was a local community advisory board made up of community economic development folks, mental health workers, legal advocates, and so forth. And they along with Tamika Palmer, Breonna Taylor's mother, really decided upon the content of the show. And so what made that so different is that typically what museums do is they bring in a curator to decide what it is the community wants to, should see. And in this case, a curator was brought on but given direction about what it is, what kind of content ought to be shown. And what's her name? Sadiqa Reynolds, a former head of the Urban League, the CEO, said it was the first time her people ever felt comfortable going into a museum, going into that museum. And so the museum really became a community-building institution. And it's that kind of thing that gives me a lot of hope for integrating the work of community organizations and the world of art. Because when you have that, you've got a strong relationship. Yeah.
And I want to say I've been kind of selfish in this conversation, Ken, and talking about visual and spoken, but I can't forget the musicians. I'm not a musician or a singer, but I can't forget their impact as well, because, of course, you talk about that in the book, too. And we all know there are music. I mean, there are songs that we hear, and we can feel the messages and the import of the messages that they sing. And, of course, even at certain events, you can hear these songs being played. What is your hope? Because for me, as a reader, when I finished the book, the big thing that I took away from it, Ken, was it really helps you to look at the idea of art in a different way. You know, art used to be kind of marginalized, right? And seen as not being as important as other things. I remember when I used to tell people I wanted to be an artist, they said, well, but what's going to be your real thing? You know, what's going to be the real thing? I think this really shows not only that art has power, but art is something that is impactful for all of us. But what was your hope as the writer that artworks would do for us?
It's my hope that by looking at models of collaboration between artists and communities, that it will serve to reinforce its value. It's really that simple, because we want to win. All of us want social change in the right direction, and we're not going to have that unless we know how to address both the heart and the mind.
Well, it's a powerful conversation for us to be able to have, and I'm so glad you're here with us. Again, everyone, Ken Grossinger has been our guest. The book is Art Works, How Organizers and Artists Are Creating a Better World Together. The book is available through our friends at Amazon.com. As I think I referenced earlier, it's published by The New Press. You can also visit their website, thenewpress.com. Ken, how can our audience, though, stay connected with you?
My email address is artworksbook.com, and the website is artworksbook.com. So one or the other, artworkbooks.com, is probably the best.
All right. Well, Ken, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. I'm so glad to have you on the broadcast and looking forward to speaking with you again.
Thanks so much, Cyrus.
More than welcome. And we thank your audience for tuning in to another great segment of Conversations Live. Until next time, I'm your host, Cyrus Webb, saying, as always, enjoy your day, enjoy your life, enjoy your world. Thank you all for choosing Conversations Live, and let's go make today amazing. Take care.